Tonight is another special offering for Tuesday evenings. Last week, Adam Lerner, the director of the MCA Denver, began the season giving an account of how he is shifting the paradigm of the museum by introducing the absurd as a means of sharing the risk taken by the artists that the museum shows. And for the March lectures, we hear from three outstanding individuals who uniquely address artistic and curatorial practice and kind of where those things might merge. As mentioned, Rhea is here the 21st. Noah Semblist follows on the 28th. And tonight we have Alina Katsoff. Alina seems particularly important to me at this moment. She is an extremely bright and impassioned thinker who ambitiously pursues her interest to the benefit of those who encounter her work. As Director of Strategy and Protocol, and I'll give you a minute to think about that, Director of Strategy and Protocol, for the Israeli Performance Research Group Public Movement, Alina is here tonight to enlighten us on this important collaborative project while also focusing on other aspects of her work as an independent curator and writer. Now based in New York and teaching at Bard Center for Curatorial Study, Alina has organized exhibitions and performances with White Columns, Andrew Krepp's Gallery, Regina Rex, and Lucy Fontaine, all in New York. With an MFA from Glasgow School of Art in 2007, she also organized exhibitions in her apartment in Glasgow under the pseudonym A. Verman. And I actually wrote the pronunciation so I would get that right. So do you get it? A. Verman. In 2010, she was a participant of De Appel curatorial program in Amsterdam, where she co-curated I'm Not Here, an exhibition without Frances Elise. Yeah, I love that. I don't know, do some of you remember Frances Elise being in the Mexico Inside Out exhibition? And if you're like me, you have a crush on Frances Elise. So I think an exhibition without Frances Elise, I didn't know you could do that. I'm going to do one of those. She was also a Museum Hub Fellow at the New Museum in 2011 and a Volkswagen Fellow at MoMA PS1 in 2012. Alina's writing is extensive, with essays and exhibition catalogs and short-form writing in various publications, including C Magazine, Canadian Art, Kaleidoscope, and Map Magazine. Her essay about the Times Square show of the 1980s was published in the anthology The Artist as Curator, this past year, so in 2016. In conjunction with Public Movement, Alina co-authored the book Solution 263, Double Agent, as part of the Solution series in 2015. This year, Alina is co-curating the first U.S.-based film commission by the Berlin artist duo Pauline Boudreau and Renata? That simple? I thought it was Renata. Okay. Renata Lorenz. So the Berlin artist duo Pauline Boudreau and Renata Lorenz, which will premiere during a solo exhibition at Participant Inc. and travel to the Contemporary Art Museum in Houston. And I meant to get the date. Do you know what the dates are that it would be at the CAM? So in the fall, maybe we need to do a road trip to Houston to see that. Public Movement most recently performed last September. I believe this was the most recent performance. Last September at the Guggenheim in New York. And of that show, Risa Pulio wrote a lengthy and glowing review for Hyperallergic in which she proclaims, quote, the most conceptually compelling work of art in the Guggenheim's exhibition, but a storm is blowing from paradise. Contemporary art of the Middle East and North Africa is also its least visible. Debriefing Session 2 by Public Movement, a research-driven Israeli collaborative, takes the form of a secret one-on-one meeting between a public movement agent and a participating audience member. Very intriguing, which I think is a great way to set up tonight's lecture. So would you please join me in warmly welcoming Alina Katsoff.
Thank you, Terry, John, and Michael, and thank you, Terry, for that introduction. I have to say that when I arrived today, Terry and I were walking through the galleries and looking at the work that was there, and we started talking about Andrea Fraser because there's that incredible Friend Sandbag work up, and you mentioned that Andrea had read that piece about Fred here, and I thought that rang a bell, and then when you got up and stood at the podium, I'm so overwhelmed by this feeling because I've listened to that recording so many times, and because all of our correspondence was over email, I hadn't quite caught that it was your voice in that recording. So I feel really, I actually feel really overwhelmed right now, and kind of emotional about that, and very grateful to be here. So, truly, thank you for the hospitality and for the chance to stand and speak in this place. And for those of you listening to the audio recording in the future, I just took my hands and made like a shape like a house over my head. If we ever get there. So I'm looking at the time now. It's about 7:10. And I'm going to do my best to leave us time for questions at the end, so I may make little adjustments as we go. Let's see where this takes us. In my work as a curator, a producer, a writer, and an artist, I'm trained to think about institutional structures. So thus the Fraser interlude feels especially meaningful. And by that I mean I think a lot about museums, galleries, and art collections and how they fit together with art. The image that's behind me is an image of me giving a talk about Louise Bourgeois' beautiful sculpture, Quarantania. And I chose to begin with it tonight in part because I know that Terry really enjoyed that talk, which meant a lot to me, because it was also a talk that I loved giving because I'm so moved by Bourgeois and her genius. It's also an image that I chose because it portrays what curators and historians are often doing, right? We're often standing in rooms with art, speaking and thinking about art and how it's framed. And I gave the talk as part of the series 99 Objects, which was held in conjunction with the collection exhibition called America is Hard to See, which inaugurated the new building for the Whitney Museum of American Art in 2015. And I wanted to start today with the piece also because it's an example of some of Bourgeois' earliest sculpture. Bourgeois, who was married to her husband, Robert Goldwater, in 1938, left Paris that same year and moved to New York. During World War II, she was cut off from her family and former life in France, which caused her immense loneliness, fear, and a sense of loss. It's a resonance that can be found throughout her work from those years. Though there are different readings of this piece, which you can only see half of it, which is called Quarantania, some historians believe that the gathering of these individual figures, her personnage, reflect a kind of yearning for togetherness. I won't speak more about the piece tonight, especially since you're going to have the incredible treat of the venerable artist and curator Robert Storr come to visit you soon, and he just published what is sure to be a really special book about Bourgeois. Instead, tonight, I'm going to talk about my work as an artist curator and specifically about my collaboration with the performative research group Public Movement and the ways in which the curatorial and the choreographic have come together in our shared practice. So To begin, I wanted to say that Public Movement is a performative research group that investigates and stages political actions in public spaces. It was founded by Omer Krieger and Dani Yahalomi in 2006, and Yahalomi took on sole leadership in 2011. As it happened during that transition moment for the group in 2011, I was working, as Terry mentioned earlier, as a museum of hub, as hub fellow at the New Museum in New York, where I helped organize a residency for Public Movement. They were preparing a major new work for an upcoming triennial called The Ungovernables that was curated by Anji Ju for the museum there in 2012. I was captivated by Public Movement's work, by the intensity, tenacity, and fearlessness with which Dani Yahalomi approached her residency and also her practice at large. The outcome of the residency was a series of performative discursive events collectively called Salons Birthright Palestine? They were staged as congressional sessions, summit meetings, visioning sessions, diplomatic consultations, and demonstrations. Extending the exhibit beyond the museum, each salon took place in different locations around Manhattan. And this image behind me is from the visioning session, which took place at the Viralist Center at the New School. To make the work, we negotiated with funding bodies, patrons, former participants of Birthright Israel, representatives of the Israeli consulate, Jewish cultural centers, and Muslim community organizations, Palestinian activists, students, lawyers, artists, and academics. All of this yielded critical material at the heart of a complex set of geopolitical relationships regarding nation branding, modernism, culture, and capital. What we found was that what took place behind the scenes during the research and organization of the salons came to be just as, if not more, poignant than the events themselves. What took place touched directly on important relationships between funding for the arts, the American-Israeli lobby, the boycott divestment sanctions movement, and the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott of Israel. What you see here, sorry, I want to just finish that and just say that to deal with this material, we created a scripted performance called Debriefing Session 1. The debriefing session performances are at the heart of the work that I've done with Public Movement. In brief, they're a one-on-one meeting that takes place between one audience member and a Public Movement agent. During the meeting, which lasts approximately 20 minutes, the agent delivers a carefully scripted breakdown of the negotiations that took place while we were organizing the salons and addresses cultural boycott specifically. The piece, which is staged in a hotel lobby under the watchful eye of a security guard, exists in the transition between research and action. And Noah Symbolist, who's here, knows the piece well because he hosted us in New Orleans, where we staged it in a hotel lobby there. Thank you, Noah. I'm going to come back to the debriefing performances soon, but before we get into them in more detail, I wanted to give you a better sense of Public Movement's overall practice because I think it will help explain why this was such a massive transition for the group and some of the nuance of what we'd created together. So Public Movement investigates and stages political actions in public spaces using constructs like civil pilgrimage, the right of return, nation branding, civic bodies, the choreography of protest and of museum collections. Public Movement raises questions about nationality and heritage. A key Public Movement strategy has to do with the concept that politics exists inside of our bodies as an often dormant knowledge. The imperative is to think about art within the production of ideology, and specifically about culture as it pertains to national identity. Public Movement agents pursue speculative questions by engaging in real interactions with the principles at the core of such phenomena. When an institution invites Public Movement to make a project, we generally arrive carte blanche without a concept in place. As such, the work is research-heavy. Public Movement arrives a little bit like scientists or sociologists, I always say, making meetings with historians, diplomats, and activists. We walk around the city where we were invited to work, learning the history and the geopolitical mapping of the city. Only by the end of the first or second visit can the idea for an action be developed, In this way, our actions are site-specific and time-specific, and these are key public movement strategies. So public movement is studying and creating civic choreographies. And what I mean by this is quite literally, at the beginning, public movement members were training with rescue units, firefighters, and the Israeli Defense Force to build a vocabulary of movement. Public movement then takes that vocabulary of movement and stages overt and covert rituals, forms of social order, and the choreography of protest. Public movement explores regulations, forces, agents, and policies. Anything really that involves the formation of identity and systems of movement, those systems of movement specifically that govern the dynamics of public life and of public space. So another way to say it is that public movement is interested in the kind of choreographies that we experience as citizens, that are absorbed by our bodies, that are held within our bodies. One of the central questions that public movement deals with, especially in the beginning, was what can we do in a group that you can't do alone? As Hannah Arendt said, one can only act politically jointly, not in isolation. So, for example, before I met Yahalomi, public movement had been studying youth journeys, such as the ones that bring Israeli teenagers a year or two before they enter the military to Poland to visit the former concentration camps. March of the Living is the largest activity that these trips orient themselves around. It's a massive march from Auschwitz to Birkenau, and people come from all over the world. Public movement created a march, a manifestation, a guided tour, and an urban walk along a new route through the ghetto in Warsaw, in the footsteps of Israeli and Jewish youth delegations, which visit the city every spring. Only public movement created new stopping points and rituals along the route. These new stops included the ghetto uprising command bunker at 18 Millis Street, the house in which Ludwig Zamenhof, who invented Esperanto, which is a language that was created, the idea was that it would be universally shared. And so they visited the house where he lived. They visited the memorial of the German Chancellor, Willy Brandt, where he knelt down in the 1970s as an apology and commemoration of what had happened. The closing ceremony took place at the Rappaport Memorial for the heroes of the ghetto uprising, with the layering of a public movement wreath, a speech, and a dance for the Rappaport Memorial. Elias Canetti reminds us in his book, Crowds and Power, that the transitional moment from being a bunch of individual people to becoming a crowd is a moment of discharge in a bodily sense. What do people discharge from? They discharge from their social status, their property, their inequality, their differences, and their distances. There is a discharge from your own preferences or beliefs. Your body's in a crowd and temporarily connected in that way. When the crowd runs, you run. When I'm leaning against a stranger, walking in a rhythm that I didn't choose, but I'm taken over by the crowd, I feel almost elevated. Public movement worked with Dr. Jackie Feldman, an anthropologist who wrote a book about the youth journeys. He refers to them as civil pilgrimage, driven from the notion of Victor Turner's communitas. Israel was one of the first countries to appropriate this notion of civil pilgrimage, which is essentially a religious strategy, and apply the method towards nation building. As you can imagine, by repeating the same ceremony, reading the same words, singing the same anthem, making the same physical movement, the people become and feel themselves as one body. Feldman writes about the phenomenon of becoming a part of and a physical carrier of history. By being in a particular place and the feeling that you have the responsibility to keep the story alive and that you're an agent of sorts of a catastrophe that has happened. As David Kurtzer says, in simultaneity lies the foundation of political cooperation. When we claim that we do politics, it depends exactly on this mass event. The intensity of this togetherness is something we understand conceptually, and even more, it's something to experience, and it's part of the physical education of becoming a citizen. This physical education of becoming a citizen is significant for many reasons, not least of all because we understand that commemorative rituals can build political solidarity even in the absence of ideological consensus. While public movement was developing a choreographic vocabulary based on the study of protest and other acts of citizenship, I was learning about the history of exhibitions. If we look back in time, we can see that exhibitions as a mode of knowledge distribution were critical in shaping concepts like national heritage. This relationship was crystallized in the form of international exhibitions, world fairs, and the national pavilions at the turn of the century. Tony Bennett's writing about the exhibitionary complex has been an important resource for me here, as has the work of an extraordinary technician and exhibitions like The Unmaking of Art, which was based on a lecture by Walter Benjamin at EFLUX in 2015. In the 18th century, revolutionaries stormed royal palaces, triggering a turn in which, among other things, the private domains of the ruling class were transformed into public exhibition halls. This is an image of Robert Hubert's painting, An Imaginary View of the Grand Gallery of the Louvre in Ruins. Now, during the French Revolution, revolutionary guards were actually positioned at the entrance of the Louvre. The citizens were storming all sites of power, and it could have been easy to imagine that they might have taken the paintings from inside, which used to belong to the king, and to take them, destroy them, or use them for the people. Removing them from the palace would make the new citizen ultimately the owner of cultural heritage. But the revolutionary guards were there to make sure that this new citizen would be able to use the site later and transform it into a public museum. In Hubert's painting, which was exhibited in the Louvre in 1796, he portrays the Grand Gallery as a symbolic ruin. This is one of many moments that shapes and articulates the uniting power of the museum as a tool that defines national identity. As international exhibitions, world's fairs, and national pavilions became popular in the mid-19th century, the objects in these exhibition halls became organized and displayed according to a narrative of progress. As sites, museums, and exhibition spaces were a training ground for civic behavior, the rituals of which are closely connected to the choreography of democracy. What I mean by this is that the population, literally the people, the demographics of which were changing, began to enter into these new spaces. The exhibitions introduced a set of structural ideologies through the display of technology from new urban centers and stolen artifacts from the colonies. This framework was instructive not only because it began to build a certain narrative of discovery, but too because they taught the newly formed democratic body how to behave in public. There were literally information cards about how to dress when attending an exhibition, how to act and how to speak, what volume your voice should be. So people were literally being trained in how to move as a crowd. It was unprecedented. Exhibitions are closely connected to our foundational ideas about democracy, public space, citizenry, and economics. Central to this is the complicated relationship between modernity and colonialism and the various injustices that have been carried out in their names. As part of the phenomenon of the world fairs, at the 1855 Exhibition Universelle in Paris, there was this moment, this threshold moment, and it was the first time that an expo had organized an international exhibition of current art. The exhibition was organized according to national pavilions, and the idea was that each would display the characteristics of its own national school. This narrative that creates a link between cultural heritage and cultural identity was forged at these world fairs. Boris Schatz, a Lithuanian sculptor who exhibited at the Exhibition Universelle in Paris in 1900, and then later oversaw the construction of the Bulgarian Pavilion in St. Louis in 1904, saw firsthand how formative this narrative was. Schatz was the one who went on to convince the 1905 Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, to found the first school for Hebrew folk art in Palestine. So the impact of this structural thinking is clear, and in the case of Israel, we see an articulation and assertion of these principles. The city of Tel Aviv was built according to the European ideals of public space. which included urban zones such as the Boulevard, the Town Square, and of course, the Museum. And so it was that by the time the State of Israel was declared in 1948, the meeting between art and the public body played a key and articulated role in shaping national identity and our notions of citizenship. The phenomenal performative relationship between the state and its cultural institutions was perhaps best exemplified when the Declaration of the State of Israel was staged at the Tel Aviv Museum of Art in 1948. There are many codependencies that exist between culture and the state, in which the rationale of one determines the other. The nation-state and its institutional appendages strive to create the illusion of a stable, consistent authority. This paradigm is still in play today, even as the opacity of a national framework dissolves. Yehalomi and I meet in this place, in the discourse that explores these phenomena. By this time, we had developed a meaningful conversation, as she had asked if I would stay on and continue working with public movement after my fellowship at the New Museum had ended. And I did, and we co-created the first debriefing session and embarked on 5 years of intensive work together, the outcome of which you will see in some of this presentation. Now, during those years, I co-conceptualized major projects, wrote and directed performative lectures and scripts. In that time, together, we raised questions about nationality and heritage, museum collections, tourism, and nation branding, the status of the archive, and always about performance and public space. One of our major projects, National Collection, regards the museum as an arena where civic behavior is staged and where national identities are defined. Drawing on the historical and contemporary contexts embodied by the museum's architecture, collections, gathering spaces, and codes of conduct, public movement activated political and national mechanisms by engaging the participant in a series of actions and new choreographies. In this light, the museum collection is not assessed for the material value of artworks, but as a visual body through which society is defined. What you see in this slide is the original building of the Tel Aviv Museum of Art on Rothschild Boulevard, which is now a museum called the Independence Hall. So it's there to commemorate the declaration of the State of Israel from within the original site of the Tel Aviv Museum of Art. For the exhibition National Collection, what we did is we temporarily returned the Independence Hall to the Hall of Art to demonstrate the interdependency between the two institutions. So here you can see a reconstruction of the original room where the Declaration of the State of Israel was made. The reconstruction was created within the new edifice or building that houses the Tel Aviv Museum of Art and its collections. You can see in the picture that the paintings that were hung in the museum during the declaration have been reinstalled here. To participate in the exhibition, the audience met in the main building and then moved all through the museum's galleries, as well as spaces that are usually closed to the public. Public movement members led one group at a time through a series of activities, ceremonies, short speeches, rituals, and processions through the museum. These acts were based on 2 years of research about the museum, its structure, collection, the flow of traffic, and its location in the city opposite the Israeli military headquarters. For example, in this part of the piece, a public movement member is walking an individual audience member through the collection galleries, pointing out the little red stickers underneath the paintings that were last selected to go down to the vault in the event of a national emergency. And the stickers were actually left over from the Iraq War when there were last missiles that were threatening to come over Israel. Over the course of 5 years and through our collaboration and conversation together, public movement moved slowly from the street into the museum, but just for a time. Exploring the ways we do and don't move in museums, how the collections move, how they're organized, and what they tell us about national identity and about power. We looked at how paintings are moved and organized according to political strategies. We led people through the museum's back rooms where crates and artworks are stored, right into the belly of the museum. We spoke scripted phrases and sang songs. In this museum, there is a country, and in this country, there is a museum. Here again is the Hubert painting, of which we had a copy made and hung it at the end of the procession. As you can imagine, during the process of creating actions like this, public movement members gather extensive research. It's a substantial amount of material. Often large portions of the material inevitably stay in the background as part of our internal research process. It influences our decisions, but remains undisclosed. Sometimes it's because the material we gather isn't suited for large-scale public action, ritual, or ceremony. There's no way to use it as part of a large public event. In our experience, though, sometimes the material that ends up on the cutting room floor can be the most politically potent. To make this particular exhibition, for example, in addition to researching the relationship between institutions of art and the nation state, we conducted 2 years of research about modern art made in Palestine before 1948, working closely with many colleagues and friends and our head of research, Hagar Ophir. We visited archives, libraries, and state museums. We met with historians, curators, artists, activists, collectors, and librarians. We read narratives about the black market, auction houses, and international museum collections. During our visits to the military archives, we read accounts of the looting and destruction that took place during the wars in 1947 and 48. Some of these accounts include lists of items that witnesses saw being removed from Palestinian homes, items which included rugs, pianos, and paintings. The question of art in Palestine before 1948 is formulated in the wake of modernity by the marriage of military and culture. We became interested in the story of these paintings because they're bonded to the narrative of modernity. Thus, they're bonded to the story of the nation state. We began to research to try and find out what kind of paintings were there and who made them. To do this research, we spent time in archives, made site visits, and held interviews. But as the incredible theorist of photography and visual culture, Ariella Azulay, once said, "The archive is not a place, it's a threshold." What we found is that you can't search for something in an archival way if the organizational system does not allow for its existence. So, for example, if paintings made in Palestine before 1948 are cataloged under abandoned property as opposed to artwork, how would you find them? This systemic violence is inherent to the very same systems of classification that were put in place at the turn of the century. The experience led us to create our second debriefing performance. Debriefing session 2 was created out of necessity because there was no reasonable way to include information about the Palestinian paintings within the framework of the Tel Aviv Museum of Art. Debriefing session 2 is a 20-minute narrative account of public movement's research about modern art made in Palestine before 1948 and the ways in which that research activates current politics. It explores notions of normalization, institutional memory, archives, diaspora, and modernity within the nation state. It's always staged in a secret room within a museum of modern art. So, for example, it's been staged in the basement of a museum in a collection storage room, and it's been staged on the 7th floor in an administrative office, typically off-limits to the public. The piece draws from all of our research and readings, including the scholarship that has been done on the subject by researchers and artists like Kamal Bulata and Ganit Ankori. Debriefing session 2 gives an account of our research process to activate the current political circumstances. In other words, the telling of the story of our research process from within the museum demonstrates the ways that the historical material remains live and a matter of present circumstances and not something from the past. It's hard to explain how visceral the experience of the debriefing is without getting into the details of the piece. But I can say that the agent delivers a great deal of the information to the participant and that it moves between factual, theoretical, and poetic framing, weaving a tight path that ultimately places the viewer at the center of a political dilemma about ownership and exile. In the case of National Collection, even though we had done all of this research about Palestinian paintings made before 1948, we could not imagine a legitimate way to include the material within a large-scale exhibition in a museum in Israel. And by extension, because of the issues embedded within the piece, which have to do with colonial narratives, the black market, diaspora, smuggling, the same would hold true for any museum of modern art. And yet, it felt critical for people to experience the telling of the account of our search from within the museum in order to activate the ways that the museum is implicated within these narratives today. You'll notice that I'm not sharing the details of the performance with you here and now. It's a delicate decision that we made about this work that we do not deliver the material to large audiences, but rather only one-on-one, for many reasons, which we can perhaps address more in the question and answer session, but one is in part the importance of an oral tradition. As a method, debriefing originated within the United States Air Force during World War II, when major shifts in military strategy meant that commanding officers were no longer in the field to observe an operation. After pilots returned, they would give a detailed first-hand account of the events as they had occurred. This was in part so that pilots weren't afraid to offer contradictory reports that might implicate a superior officer. So the military needed to come up with a way to undo the hierarchies that people were normally working within. The method has since been adopted by clandestine agencies serving any number of ideological imperatives, though of course the conditions of visuality have changed since World War II. We exist in an increasingly all-consuming field of surveillance, but politics are no more readily seen. Public movement is interested in the ways that information moves and is organized according to power. We're interested in micro-positions. We engage with individuals and organizations that occupy a range of positions across the political spectrum. Our working principle is that binary or polarized positions are most likely to be co-opted. And so, to visualize the field, agents enter, navigate, and chart relationships. During each debriefing session, the public movement agent literally draws a diagram to chart the research and illustrate the deconstruction of otherwise foundational narratives. The debriefing performances are not only carefully scripted but closely choreographed. There are only four agents who have ever been trained to deliver debriefing sessions: Amir Farhoun, Hagar Ophir, Ruth Patir, and Nir Shalouf. And each went through an extensive training, dramaturgy, and direction from me. I'm quite tough when it comes to the direction of the performances, in order to perform the pieces. And you have to imagine the incredible amount of trust that goes into this process, because really when you go into the room, or if you're in the hotel lobby for debriefing one, it's really just you and the agent. So they not only need to know the script and the intonation and the sort of suggestive nuances of how to say things, but need to be able to catch any questions you might throw at them, answer them as Donna and I would have wanted them to, and then bring you back to the script. So it requires a lot of focus and dexterity and passion. The debriefing performances have been staged thus far in Jerusalem, Helsinki, Los Angeles, Munich, New Orleans, Tel Aviv, and most recently at the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum in New York. Debriefing sessions activate relationships and situations in which art is a tool in the production of political realities. The two debriefing performances were created precisely in the moment where we hit upon a place in our research that could not be resolved as large-scale performative action. In both, the participant is implicated directly in the dilemma that exists at the core of the debriefing. So the debriefing is designed to place you, the participant, at the heart of the matter. Debriefing Session is the one and the only public movement project that is designed to travel. It exists beyond the borders of cities and states, Rather, it comes alive the more frequently it comes into contact with the specificities of different institutions of modern and contemporary art. Every time the piece is staged, it excavates the particularities of a place and of its host institution, integrating them into the script to reorganize the participants' experience within the very museum where the work is staged. Each participant leaves as a carrier of information, and in this way, the piece must repeat itself to be most effective. Before I wrap up tonight, I wanted to leave with this quote from Willem Flusser. Flusser wrote about living in the diaspora, about expulsion and about the refugee, and about the agency embedded within the most dire circumstances, the power of being unknowable by a system designed to predetermine you. Public movement's premise is that art is not limited to the representation of politics. And to close, I'll read Flusser, who says, "The question of freedom is not a matter of coming and going, but of remaining a stranger." Now, I was going to end on that note tonight when I was planning this, but I've decided just to steamroll ahead for just one more minute and talk about a body of paintings, because I was meant to talk a little bit about my curatorial practice as well. These paintings that I'm showing you right now are made by the master musician Youssef Lateef, and I'm not going to take too much time talking about them to save time for questions, as I promised. But I was struck when I was walking through the galleries earlier tonight by how relevant the works feel here, in the sense that Lateef was a self-taught artist, but an extraordinary lifelong musician. His accolades are many, but why I wanted to bring it up right now was to talk a little bit about the role of improvisation in his practice and the way that the drawings performed as a kind of score for him. He had one exhibition in his life when I first saw the drawings. It's a beautiful example of how circumstance, oral tradition, and research can kind of come together and fall into your lap sometimes. A friend of mine was photographing them for him and looked at me one night when I was at his house and said, "Hey, Alina, you like art. You should come look at this. Come check it out." And there were over 100 drawings there that Lateef had been making over the last 40 years of his life. And I wanted to bring it up here because of this Flusser quote and this idea of remaining a stranger and opening up different ways of working and seeing in response to circumstance, and also the gaps that are inherently in public archives. These paintings don't yet belong in museum collections, though I deeply believe that they should. They were not only works of art that were visual, but they were also a visualization of sound. Lateef would actually play them. So he would walk up to the drawing and play the music as he read it in the work. He made the drawings in the same room that he composed over the last 45 years of his life, and he would move from the piano in the morning to drawing in the afternoon and back to the piano again. So there was a kind of seamless continuity between them. And I worked on this exhibition of his drawings. This is an example of his complex musical intervals, which I think are also really understudied, especially because they were being made around the same time that Coltrane was working and John Cage, some made with John Coltrane. And I guess I wanted to bring it up here tonight for many different reasons and end on this note. And this is maybe more personal. This is an installation shot of an exhibition that I organized with the work. I worked very closely with Youssef Lateef's widow, Aisha Lateef, and together we photographed all of the drawings and paintings that we could find and made a modest exhibition that traveled from White Columns to the Hampshire College Art Gallery and to Chernusov in Detroit. And we had people play music at each of the installations. I'm trying to find a way to bring it back around in my head to end properly, and it's the only thing. It's maybe a little bit sentimental to say, but certainly one of the things that Lateef advocated for throughout his life was to speak from the heart. So I'm going to embrace that and end that way tonight. He was one of the first musicians to incorporate instruments from the Middle East into jazz, into American jazz. And he did a lot of very famous albums, including Eastern Sounds. And when he passed away, we were about a year into the process of working together. And I happened to be in Israel on one of these research trips and spent, though he had no overt connection to Israel, was a devout Muslim. And I spent, made a trip to the Negev desert to wish him well on his journey. So in a strange way, for me, these bodies of works are bound. And maybe that's just a very honest way of talking about how sometimes very seemingly different bodies of work can come together and influence the way we form ideas. Maybe I'll end on that note and say thank you very much.
I'm going to try to walk around with the mic so that everybody can hear each other's questions. So if anybody has a question for Alina, I'll try to trek over. Right.
Please don't make me use the mic.
I'm sorry.
I have to do it. You have to do it.
So I'm wondering if you can help me.
Sure.
I like the connection from the debriefing to this work and the improvisation, but I found myself stuck on the choreography, the public art movement. And I know exactly why, and I hate to say why, but it's because I have an inherent suspicion behind a kind of uniformed, choreographed public presence as a form of intervention, because that is often the public face of the state in insidious moments.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure you must have had conversations with the group how they can flip that if they're trying to use it as a moment of intervention to be using one of the strategies that has been most often used by the state. And probably, I'm sorry, I'm going right there in the kind of worst examples of history of a kind of choreographed, orchestrated, uniformed presence. How do they grab that and turn that toward the actions and the desired goals that they have in mind?
Mm-hmm. That's an amazing question. And you're absolutely correct that we get asked a version of that question very often, but very rarely as coherently or as beautifully. No, really. Usually, thank you. There are a few answers to that, I would say, and this is where it gets tricky when I'm speaking as my curator, me, or my person, Alina. Or when I'm speaking as the director of strategy and protocol, which is a position that I take very seriously. When I give public movement lectures as the director of strategy and protocol, my language is a little different. So obviously, some of the phrasing I'm really attached to, so it regurgitates. But all of this to say that there are a few answers. I think one thing is that to shift, let's say you're in the street and you see something that looks a lot like something you've seen, either from the current state of affairs or from the past, but it's not quite like it, and you have to stop and ask yourself, how is it the same and how is it different? There, I think that there is something productive in that moment. So that's one answer, that is enough. It's enough that it's productive. It's enough that it's unclear. It's enough that it doesn't announce itself as for or against something. That pause is productive and important, actually, because sometimes it's too easy if we know what something is for or against to agree or disagree and move on with ourselves. And actually, it's that very complex and intelligent place of uncertainty where we refine ourselves, we refine our tools, right? We sharpen ourselves. We become more acute, more specific, more certain about what we believe and how these things make us feel. The reality is that that choreography that we're talking about, that I think you're referring, I'm assuming you're referring to different forms of fascism and expressions of fascism, right? They are not only in the past, I think we, you know. So it becomes important, no matter how uncomfortable it makes us, to deal with how they may or may not produce themselves in the present. Many of the people, and now, you know, Donna Yahalomi, who is my dear friend and colleague, who's the genius, and I think she is like a genius, who is the generative force behind public movement work. I think that she wouldn't say what I'm about to say explicitly, but I think that she, also there is a reality that for me as an outsider, right, as a Canadian Jewess, right, who is like trying to understand my own relationship to some of these narratives that I see. So this is now, I'm not the director of strategy and protocol, but what I also see is that the public movement members that I've worked with are still reckoning, like trauma like that, like the trauma, their ancestral trauma and the trauma of living in Israel, knowing what's happening, is in their bodies, and they're trying to understand it. And that some of this is literally just about trying to work it out. Now, is that always comfortable? No. Does it make us, is it a slippery fish? Yes. Are there important questions to ask about the role of art in society, activism, a sense of responsibility? Absolutely. But I think that we have to fight for as many different versions of art as we can, right? The worst thing would be to have only one way to approach these questions. That's the fascist way, right? Only one way. That's okay. So I'll answer this question over and over. I love answering this question because every time I get a little bit more aware of why I still do this. And it was very uncomfortable for me, the first, you know, to be associated with public movement. It's not cool looking, you know. It's not like anti-fascist, you know. It's not clear what we're doing. And I have so many friends who just can't get down with the uniforms and with the gender. The girls are in skirts and the thing, you know. So yes, of course, we've discussed this stuff for 5 years. Hours at a time, and yet the practice is the practice, and it is somehow still something I've decided to work on. I hope that answers the question a little bit.
But. I appreciate the
willingness to be uncomfortable. Sure. Yeah, it is uncomfortable. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, the microphone.
This is a question I thought about before Anne asked hers, but it ties into your response to it in mm-hmm. a lot of ways. So you talked a lot about process and structure and went in great depth about that without talking almost at all about content.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fascinating in a lot of ways. It's particularly fascinating because of the one-on-one kinds of performative piece that's a big piece of what seems to me to be the puzzle. I assume that's on purpose, but I don't know that. But I thought it was... it made the talk much more interesting in a lot of ways.
Oh, thank goodness. I thought that was going to end on, where's the content? Oh, I'm so excited and relieved to hear that. Oh, I can breathe again. No, it's, you know, part of it is on purpose, if, in the sense that with the debriefing sessions, you know, with especially with debriefing session 1 at the time when we made it, we were terrifying. And we were terrified in the sense that we literally draw a map that says this funder pays money for Birthright Palestine. They also pay money for this or a private organization that supports Israeli artists. This particular Palestinian activist refused to work with them because of this, but the money actually exists here. I mean, we were kind of like taking people behind the curtain of Oz a little bit, unless you're someone who's already deeply invested in these processes, right? We're not the first to do it. We're not the only to do it. But this was our way that we tried to do it, right? So we were scared, and it wasn't the kind of material that I would deliver in a lecture like this. Even now, even though I'm not scared anymore at all about that stuff. With Debriefing 2, it was more an issue of, like, as an Israeli group, and even though I'm not Israeli, when I'm presenting as the director of strategy and protocol, I always say we, because that's the reality. If I'm collaborating with an Israeli group, I've made a decision that's okay for me to do. I have many friends who do not work with Israelis, right, who follow the Palestinian academic and cultural boycott of Israel. We can have a long conversation about that, and it's a very interesting and very important one. It's an important nonviolent strategy. I felt I had this work to do. So all of that to say that the issues that are embedded in that have a lot to do with who owns knowledge, right? Who has the right to give a lecture about information? So if I were to stand up here and show you the pictures of the Palestinian paintings and say this one was made by so-and-so at such a time and this one was smuggled out on so-and-so's back to Syria and so on, there's a way where I would become the purveyor of that information, even if only in this moment, even if only for this hour. And it wouldn't matter how many Palestinian scholars or academics have also done that research, and I can mention them as many times as I want, I would still be standing here like an authority. And we decided not to do that. Right? So the debriefing session is the only time where I will give that material. Where it's delivered. And it's done in a way that creates a responsibility for the person who receives it so that they are implicated in the situation. They don't have it. Once they leave, they heard what they heard. There's no going back. They just have to decide how they're going to share that knowledge moving forward or not. And it's important to do it in a museum because it grounds it. When we did it at Guggenheim, the response was incredible, how people would leave the room and they walked through the museum on the way out, and the whole museum felt different, right? And that's really important, I think, for us. It's important to us. So that's one thing. Another thing is that I'm into structure, you know? Like, I'm the whole thing with the exhibition histories and systems of classification, and, like, I'm so into that. Like, I think it's cool, you know? So it's not even, it's the part of me that is interested in institutional critique and interested in the history of exhibitions and interested in how we've organized thought processes, the, you know, post-structuralism, the whole thing. I'm just into it. I get excited about it. It helps me sleep at night, basically. So that's partially why my version of the talk has a lot of that in it. And I think the other thing too is that there are just so many things to get through. Like, imagine if I were to just get up here and be like, talk for 40 minutes about the Spring in Warsaw piece, but you had no idea how I fit into the picture, who Donna was, what public movement is. So there's, like, public movement, there's me, there's our collaboration. And I meant to say this, I'm going to steal this moment and say that I was only at the New Museum for a very short time. That's the irony of all this, and I always mean to say it and forget to. But I was only there for, like, 3 months. But I met Donna Yahalomi in that time, and now we've been working together 5 years. So there's this way where that's a structural thing for me, and that feels important because it helps break down the illusion. Like, you know, I think it's important to be forthright about how these connections are made and how we build collaborations and stuff. I'm going a little off-piste, but for all those reasons, I think, yeah, if that answers.
So at the beginning, you talked about, I think you said, a public gathering. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really interested in how, you know, our sort of elite group, mm-hmm, of this information sharing as as it compares to what's been happening just in America for or the U.S. in the last 3 months, and how you see some of those public gatherings, the efficacy of them, and how that compares to these more discreet, mm-hmm. purposeful, not that those aren't purposeful, but very strategized and choreographed mm-hmm. moments.
May I just ask you for a clarification? When you say the public gatherings, do you mean the ones that I showed from Public Movement's work, or just in general?
Well, it was at the beginning something. I don't remember mm-hmm. exactly what you said, but it was I immediately thought of the Women's March.
Yep.
And
yeah.
So how
sure.
those kind of fit in. The civic sort of movement.
Sure. It was, I mean, there's so much to unpack there. So first of all, like, there are many audiences. That's just part of life. The Spring in Warsaw, the piece that's up here, there were 1,300 people who participated in that event. And often when Public Movement gives lectures, if Don and I are giving an informative lecture, we very rarely show video. But what we will show only in as video is, instead of our video documentation, we always only show news footage that's been taken of our events by actual news people, to give that extra layer so that you can understand how there is sometimes actually an audience outside the art world, especially during the in the work that Public Movement was doing before I came along. So it's my fault, really. Well, both of our faults, but, you know. So that's one short answer. In terms of what's going on today and things like the Women's March, it tortured me this week. I almost wrote an entirely different lecture because I was trying to understand how to show this work right now, given everything going on, given the fact that there is legislation being made to try and make nonviolent protest more difficult, given the various ways that we come together and come apart, let me say it that way. And the reason I didn't is that I'll just be very honest, I'm not ready. These things really matter. What's at stake really is, it's real, and it's really delicate and important to be precise. And I didn't have enough time this month to write this lecture, the version that addresses those questions as well as I would have needed to. For example, there's a piece that Public Movement did in Heidelberg, where in Heidelberg in Germany, there's a law that was put into place after 1967 where the police are not allowed to enter into the university. It's against the law because of some of the protests and riots that happened there. And Public Movement went and in classic public antagonistic form and worked with the cops, said, we're going to collaborate with the police and we're going to invite them in as part of our piece, and they will be here and perform with us in the theater. And what ended up happening was that a protest was staged. And the protest was staged largely because people, even though they knew it was a theater perform, even though they knew that it was by invitation, they couldn't allow for the cops to be there under any conditions. It felt like too slippery a slope. It was, people weren't willing to allow it. And the audience, the students, spontaneously protested. And there was a woman who was on the news footage yelling and screaming at the camera. I was telling Terry this story earlier. And afterwards, Donna interviewed her, and she said, why were you... She was beating on the cops, what's it called? Yeah, the shield. And she was yelling at him and beating on him in front of the newsreel. And Donna said, did you know that it was a theater piece? And the woman said, yes, I knew. But I had to perform because I couldn't allow the news footage to go out and make it look like no one cared that the cops were here. Now, that I love telling that story. I think it's a really productive thing. But given the situation we're in right now, and given what it means to perform, the question of performance, there's a lot of new work that I need to do to set up that piece now. Right? It's a different set of conditions. As I'm talking, I'm even regretting that this is on that, like, I don't even want anyone to hear audio of this, you know, until I have a chance to frame it appropriately so that it's clear that we're not talking about paying protest, you know, that it's not right. I don't even want to say the words out loud to diminish all this other work, but just to say that that yes, I'm thinking about it a lot, and I you know, I almost rewrote the thing to deal state by state with the legislation that's being put out and all these, but I didn't want to half-ass it, basically. I'm too slow.
I really appreciate your precision and the seriousness with which you take this. Some people were here last week when the subject was the museum sharing the risk of the artist. Mm-hmm. And this particular director has chosen the act of absurdity as a way to counterbalance the seriousness of art. And I think, I don't know, as I'm standing here, I'm thinking I've introduced you in a way as a curator, and the way you describe your position with public movement, it is this kind of director curating kind of position. But you're making art.
With Donna. With public movement.
It's collaborative. Yeah. This is the art that museum director would respect for its seriousness.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Anybody else have any questions or thoughts on tonight? I just think we've been given so much to think about. Thank you so much, Elena. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.